Genesis 45, verse 16, through to 46, verse 27. Starting at verse 16. When the report was heard in Pharaoh's house, Joseph's brothers have come, it pleased Pharaoh and his servants. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Say to your brothers, do this. Load your beasts and go back to the land of Canaan, and take your father and your households and come to me, and I will give you the best of the land of Egypt, and you shall eat the fat of the land." And you, Joseph, are commanded to say, "Do this. Take wagons from the land of Egypt for your little ones and for your wives, and bring your father and come. Have no concern for your goods, for the best of all the land of Egypt is yours." The sons of Israel did so, and Joseph gave them wagons according to the command of Pharaoh, and gave them provisions for the journey. To each and all of them he gave a change of clothes, but to Benjamin he gave 300 shekels of silver and 5 changes of clothes. To his father he sent as follows: 10 donkeys loaded with the good things of Egypt, and 10 female donkeys loaded with grain, bread, and provision for his father on the journey. Then he sent his brothers away, and as they departed, he said to them, "Do not quarrel on the way." So they went up out of Egypt and came to the land of Canaan to their father Jacob. And they told him, "Joseph is still alive, and he is ruler over the land of Egypt." And his heart became numb, for he did not believe them. But when they told him all the words of Joseph, which he had said to them, and when he saw the wagons that Joseph had sent to carry him, the spirit of their father Jacob revived. And Israel said, "It is enough. Jacob, my son, is still alive. I will go and see him before I die." So Israel took his journey with all that he had had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. And God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, "Jacob, Jacob." And he said, "Here am I." Then he said, "I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for there I will make you into a great nation. I myself will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also bring you up again, and Joseph's hand shall close your eyes." Then Jacob set out from Beersheba. The sons of Israel carried Jacob their father, their little ones, and their wives in the wagons that Pharaoh had sent to carry him. They also took their livestock and their goods, which they had gained in the land of Canaan, and came into Egypt, Jacob and all his offspring with him, his sons and his sons' sons with him, his daughters and his sons' daughters, all his offspring he brought with him into Egypt. Now these are the names of the descendants of Israel who came into Egypt, Jacob and his sons: Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, and the sons of Reuben: Hanok, Palu, Hezron, and Carmi. The sons of Simeon: Jemuel, Jamin, Ohad, Jachin, Zohar, and Shul, the son of a Canaanite woman. The sons of Levi: Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. The sons of Judah: Onan, Shelah, Perez, and Zerah. But and Onan died in the land of Canaan. And the sons of Perez were Hezron and Hamul. The sons of Issachar: Tola, Puvah, Yob, and Shimron. The sons of Zebulun: Zered, Elon, and Jalil. These are the sons of Leah, whom she bore to Jacob in Paddan Aram, together with his daughter Dinah. Altogether, his sons and his daughters numbered 33. The sons of Gad: Ziphion, Haggi, Shuni, Esbon, Eri, Erodi, and Arli. The sons of Asher: Imnah, Ishvah, Ishvi, Beriah, with Sarah, their sister. And the sons of Beriah: Heber and Malkiel. These are the sons of Zilpah, whom Laban gave to Leah, his daughter, and these she bore to Jacob, 16 persons. The sons of Rachel, Jacob's wife: Joseph and Benjamin. And to Joseph in the land of Egypt were born Manasseh and Ephraim, who Asnath, the daughter of Potipharah, the priest of On, bore to him. And the sons of Benjamin: Bela, Besher, Ashbel, Gera. Naaman, Ehi, Rosh, Muppim, Hippim, and Ard. These are the sons of Rachel who were born to Jacob, 14 persons in all. The son of Dan, Hishim. The sons of Naphtali, Jahziel, Guni, Jezer, and Shillem. These are the sons of Bilhah, whom Laban gave to Rachel his daughter, and these she bore to Jacob, 7 persons in all. All the persons belonging to Jacob who came into Egypt, who were his own descendants, not included Jacob's sons' wives, were 66 persons in all. And the sons of Joseph, who were born to him in Egypt, were 2. All the persons of the house of Jacob who came into Egypt were 70.
Thank you very much for joining us today, and can I add my welcome to Tom's, and thanks for that reading, Carrie. Can I just suggest that there are some really excellent names for anyone looking for the name of a son yet to be born? Can I just draw your attention to the end of verse 21? There are 3 candidates. Christian Fiddler, you're expecting a son not too long away. Muppin, Huppin, Ard. I mean, those are just great, aren't they? As we were practicing, well, as my wife, Carrie, was practicing last night, she said, how can I say that without getting the giggles? Anyway, you did very well. We'll come to the genealogy. This feels like a short straw, doesn't it? We'll come to that later on. Let's dive straight in, shall we? We're in a sort of another bit of the narrative. We're coming to the end. I guess we could call this the home straight of Genesis, 50 chapters, and we're getting there. And the book is all about God establishing people for himself. That's why Genesis was written. God establishing a people for himself. And so the focal point of the book is a God who makes promises. And the promises or covenant that he makes are essentially repeated 7 times. Firstly, he makes those promises to Abraham, and then to his son Isaac, and then finally to Jacob, the patriarchs, as we call them. And he essentially says the same thing to all of those men 7 times. Slight nuances, depending on the sort of situation that the particular patriarch is in, but down to these 3 elements. People. I will make people, numerous people. Gives wonderful illustrations like sand and stars, that sort of thing. They're going to be blessed. Primarily, that's about a right relationship with God. And then thirdly, in a land, the promised land. And so that recurring mantra through the book of Genesis helps us to understand the main issue in our text today. It's a bit of a shock when they leave the promised land. We didn't really see that coming, when it's been so focused on the land and the people in it up until this point. Jacob and his extended family pack up their tents and move out. The promised land is to be exited. How do we call that? The promised land exit, Brexit, something like that going on. And I think that the point is, as you sort of read through, not what we expected, bit of a surprise. And so it'd be perfectly reasonable to ask at this stage, what on earth is God doing? And I think that helps us to see the sort of the main idea that we're sort of pushing at. When things look up in the air, when the unexpected happens, God can be trusted. That's really where we land today. We catch up with the story in Egypt. Joseph and his brothers are now reconciled. And Joseph has urged his brothers to go back to Canaan, get their father, Jacob, urgently bring him into Egypt. Brings us to the first point there, you'll see on the handout, quite a full handout, lots of sort of sub-points, so you know where we're going today. First main point though, God's people heading into Egypt. And to underscore both the legitimacy of the invitation originally made by Joseph to his brothers, to underscore the legitimacy of that and to convince us of God's hand in all of this, Pharaoh repeats the invitation. Have a look at 45 verse 17. Pharaoh said to Joseph, say to your brothers, do this, load your beasts, go back to the land of Canaan and take your father and your households and come to me and I will give you the best of the land of Egypt and you shall eat the fat of the land. This book by Derek Kidner, it was left to me by my grandfather. It's definitely to be described as a bit of a gem, and he puts it very well in these verses. He says, this royal invitation for Joseph's sake to an Israel near the end of hope and to 10 brothers burdened with guilt can hardly fail to remind the Christian of the divine, "Come and I will give." Look at verse 18 again. You see, as Pharaoh says, "Come to me and I will give you the best of the land." Look on at verse 20, "Have no concern for your goods, for the best of the land of Egypt is yours." You see, here is a stunning invitation into Egypt, and it functions for us in a number of ways. I'm sure there are more. I put down the three main ways that I think it functions for us. Firstly, a glimpse of heaven. I mean, can you imagine just for a moment being the honored guest of not just the richest and most powerful man in the world, but to bring in your extended family and to come not just for dinner, not a holiday, but for the rest of your life. It's quite an invitation, isn't it? Come. Everything that I have is yours, says Pharaoh, top dog in the world at the time. I'm sure many of us will have had the sort of experience where you get dragged around a stately home by your parents, or maybe you're at the age where you start to do that sort of thing yourself, thinking it's sort of grown up and sophisticated, and or maybe, you know, it's still sort of MTV and Hollywood cribs, but you get this sort of this idea of a life into an A-lister's world that's sort of covered in gold taps and carpeted corridors and just opulence everywhere. Well, that parallel life with the sort of to die for views, all of that is now to be for God's people, for Jacob and this ridiculously large crowd of children that he's got in his gang. And it makes a serious and a wonderful point in the flow of the text. Pharaoh says, "I will give you the best. You will eat of the fat of the land." And here is a glimpse of what all God's people look forward to. Not in this life, let's be clear. This is a glimpse of the end. Remember, the book is drawing to a close, the end of the patriarchal period. Here is a good sort of close to a major, major sort of part of salvation history. Ultimately, episodes like this stand out, and they give us a picture of heaven, of the new creation. Consider Jesus as he stepped onto the scene. You remember his first miracle, his first sign in John's gospel, as he turned water into wine? It's incredible, isn't it? The best wine is brought out. Endless supply. There are sort of magnums and Jeroboams everywhere. And everyone's saying, "Where'd you get this incredible stuff from?" A picture of the new creation, of the messianic age. And it helps us to appreciate, little things like this just help us to appreciate what God's actually got in store for his people. In small groups recently, we've been going through Romans. Romans will be familiar to most of us here. And we've been thinking lots about the suffering and hardships of this world. And Paul's point that we saw last week in our small group studies, future glory, heaven we could say, it far outweighs anything that you could ever experience in this world. Here is a spotlight for us on what that future looks like. But you see, God's people entering Egypt, it's much more than just a glimpse of heaven. Their move away from Canaan and into Egypt was a fulfillment of what God said. That's the second subpoint. Because things always happen the way that God says they will happen. They always happen exactly the way he says. And you see, right back at the start, I said that Genesis is a book where God repeats his sort of his covenant promises to his people. Well, right back at the start, in one of the early conversations with Abraham, in fact, even before he was called Abraham, when he was known as Abram, God said this. In fact, it's worth seeing yourself. I think it's on page 11. Turn back to Genesis 15. Genesis 15, verse 13. It's really interesting. Right down at the start, God says this: "The Lord said to Abram, 'Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years.'" See what's happening now? They're going into that land, exactly as God said it would be. Flick back to where we are in 45, 46. Now, a reminder, of course, that this certainty won't be heaven-like for long. A time of affliction is coming, we know as readers. How much that was in the sights of Jacob and his family, we don't know. And, of course, I mean, the troubles of tomorrow are tomorrow's trouble. For now, here is God demonstrating that when he says he will do something, he does it. And so you see, the move to Egypt is perfectly in line with God's plan. The move also, though, thirdly, a third little sort of spotlight on how this move into Egypt functions, an incubator, I'm going to call it, for God's people. An incubator is where something grows and is kept safe and develop. As one commentator puts it, Egypt is the womb that God uses to form his nation. You see, that was always the intention. The land that they were to settle in would allow them to multiply unhindered, unhindered by the stress and the trouble of the surrounding Canaanite nations. Pharaoh settled them in Goshen. That was the best of the land. That was the land of the opulence. And there they formed a community within Egypt. They were a large family at this stage, 70, we're told towards the end, but they would grow. In fact, we read in the middle of the book of Exodus that by the time they leave Egypt, 430 years later, well, there's 600,000 men by that stage, adding women and children, we can only estimate, but probably 2.5 million. This would be the place where God's people would grow and develop. So you see, the move away from famine-stricken Canaan, the promised land, into Egypt functions in all of these different ways. And I think, though, the bit that's grabbed me the most, I put in the second point there, the way that God achieves all of this. God fulfills his plan through a risen man. To appreciate this, we need to go back and sort of step into Jacob's shoes a little bit. Remember, he's back in Canaan. He's an old man at this stage, very much a remainer. You know, he's a man to stick around in Canaan. But his perspective is about to be changed. Up until this point, he has assumed that his son, Joseph, is dead. Back in chapter 37, the last thing he'd heard about Joseph was that his other sons had given him Joseph's multicolored coat, being ripped into shreds and covered in animal blood. He'd given him that. Here is proof that your son is dead, his other sons said. And so from Jacob's perspective, he's got very used to that now, well over a decade by this point. Here, Jacob's sons return. Let's catch up with the story. Chapter 45, verse 25. So they went up out of Egypt, came to the land of Canaan to their father Jacob, and they told him, Joseph is still alive, and he is ruler over all of the land of Egypt. Now, just pause on this for a moment. I think this is fascinating. Remember how Joseph functions, if you've been with us for the last few weeks. In Joseph, we have a picture of the Christ figure, the Messiah. He's like the Christ. And I think more than ever, we see that at this point. Verse 26, Joseph is alive. I mean, from Jacob's point of view, he has risen from the dead. Verse 26, Joseph is ruler over all the land of Egypt. At this stage, the superpower of the world, it might as well have been the world that he ruled over. The New Testament consistently links the fact that Jesus' resurrection from the dead makes him Lord, Lord over this world. And here we see a parallel to that. We saw that in Romans, again, familiar text for most of us. By his resurrection from the dead, Jesus Christ, our Lord. The two always go hand in hand. Look at chapter 45, verse 26 again. They told him, Jacob, Joseph is still alive and he's ruler over all the land. And so as the first book of salvation history is written, do you see how God is beginning to train his people in this fundamental idea of resurrection from the dead? To a certain extent, he did do that with Abraham, as his son Isaac was figuratively, that's how the New Testament speaks about it, figuratively brought back from the dead. But now again, the idea of resurrection is enshrined in the patriarch's history. This is the foundation. This is how God's people are to make sense of God's promises throughout time. Here is the pattern for the way God fulfills promises through a risen man. Well, not surprisingly, remember, back in Jacob's shoes for a moment, all this is a little bit too much for Jacob. Old man at this point, verse 26, his heart became numb, for he did not believe them. You can't really blame him. Gripped with unbelief, he had good reason to believe that Jacob was dead. He got used to it for a long time. The suggestion that a man had risen from the dead was preposterous. It always is. But like Jesus' disciples many years later, Jacob came round to the idea. Look at verse 27. But when they told him all the words of Joseph, which he had said to them, and when he saw the wagons that Joseph had sent to carry them, the spirit of the father Jacob revived. It's a wonderful turning point. He was convinced their testimony, and also the cavalcade of special sort of armor-plated wagons that Pharaoh had sent to pick him up. That was enough. End of verse 27, the spirit of the of their father Jacob revived. Why the wagons? Well, I guess if they were going to fabricate a story, I mean, you can turn up with a few sort of impressive donkeys and things full of things, can't you? You can turn up with an amazing story, but it's quite hard to turn up with Pharaoh's own cavalcade of wagons. And so that seemed to be the sort of the tipping point. He was convinced. The words sounded plausible, credible, he decided. I mean, it's a little bit dangerous, isn't it, to speculate too much. Could this be the point of Jacob's conversion? He's always been a little bit of a rat bag through the book of Genesis. But there's a complete turnaround here, the point of coming to faith. I mean, every other time, I mean, so much sort of dubious behavior in his family. It fits with what we saw last week. Remember the turnaround of his brothers? Sorry, not Jacob's brothers, Joseph's brothers. Remember the huge turnaround then? All his sons, massive sort of A to B change around. And arguably, all of this change that's taken place in individuals is down to the fact that Joseph is back from the dead and that he's risen to power. It's just an interesting parallel, isn't it? The way that this changes people. Now, I don't want to speculate too much. The Old Testament doesn't make much of the idea of conversion. We shouldn't get too distracted. But what is clear from the text is that Jacob is a changed man. I mean, look at the effect, for example, the own outlook that he has on his own death. I put that as a subpoint. I thought it was quite significant. Death for Jacob loses its sting. Look at verse 28. Israel, that's another name for Jacob, said, "It is enough. Joseph, my son, is still alive. I will go and see him before I die." That is a huge turnaround. If you've been following the sort of the comments about the man Jacob, since he got the news of Joseph's death, it's been nothing but doom and gloom. Back in chapter 37, he hears the news. All his sons and his daughters rose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. He said, "No, I shall go down to Sheol to my son mourning." Thus Jacob wept. And that's basically all that happens through chapter 42, through chapter 44. Gray hair, death, Sheol. That's all we're told about Jacob. But now, for the first time, everything changes. The prospect of seeing Joseph has given him a fresh perspective. And it's hardly surprising, is it? Again, we find this same idea in the New Testament. The resurrection of Jesus from the dead is proof to the Christians that we can have a positive and an upbeat attitude towards our own death and towards those who've died in Christ's death. That is exactly the link that is made. In 1 Corinthians 15, you see that really clearly. Those famous words, "O death, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting?" How can we feel like that about death? Paul says to the Corinthians, because we have victory through Jesus Christ because of his resurrection from the dead. Well, Jacob's thrill of the news of Joseph's life, his rise to power, it not only revives his spirit, but it gives him this quite sort of refreshed, upbeat view. For the first time, death does not seem to worry him. But then the last subpoint there on this main second point, Jacob is excited about. Look at what he's excited about. It's really interesting. The text has given us detail after detail of the luxury of Egypt, the fat of the land. But that's no incentive for Jacob. He couldn't really care less about all of that. On the contrary, all he cares about is Joseph. 45 verse 28, it's enough. Joseph, my son is still alive. I will go and see him. Another writer puts it like this, a father and brothers once driven by the pursuit of property and money now love the brother above all these things, and they use their provisions and gifts to serve that relationship. That's all that matters to any of them right now, a Joseph-centered future. You see, in the end, if we are lacking excitement about glory, if we don't find it much of a sort of a motivation, it won't be the flowing wine or the gold taps or the luxury that gets us excited. It's not that we need more of that. Our spirits in the end will be revived by the risen ruler, Jesus. You see, he alone can give us the world that we were made for. C.S. Lewis captures this brilliantly in Mere Christianity. It's an absolute must-read if you've never got around to it. And C.S. Lewis says this: "If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. If none of my earthly pleasures satisfy it, that does not prove that the universe is a fraud. Probably, earthly pleasures were never meant to satisfy it, but only to arouse it, to suggest the real thing." The world we were made for as human beings. Remember, that's the whole focus of Genesis. God establishing a people in a land that he's going to set apart for eternity in right relationship with him. Well, the world that we were made for is Jesus-centered. And I think that's probably the distinctive that drives our trust, or should drive our trust. I'll come back to that at the end in a few minutes when we close. For now, though, let's just deal with some of this language at the end, the genealogy, as come to the final point there. You'll see God's promises stand through the unwanted experiences of life. See the news of Joseph? It's enough. I guess Jacob is happy to sort of jump onto those wagons and head off at this point. Verse 1, 46 verse 1, Israel took his journey with all that he had, and he came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. Israel, Jacob, two different names. I'll make a comment on that at the moment. He arrives in Beersheba. Beersheba's on the southern border of the Promised Land. In other words, last stop of the Promised Land before you get into Egypt. The perfect place for God to confirm to Jacob that he was indeed doing the right thing. God's promises stand, even though right now it looks ridiculous to be leaving the Promised Land and going into the land of hostility. Verse 2, God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, "Jacob, Jacob." Now, Israel and Jacob, same name, but they're used interchangeably. Israel, of course, was a nation name. Jacob was a name of weakness, very personal. And so here is God addressing Jacob very personally. And he said, "Here am I." Then God said, verse 3, "I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for there I will make you into a great nation. I myself will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also bring you up again. And Joseph's hand shall close your eyes." It's a kind thing of God to do, isn't it? To give Jacob assurance at this point. Same old wonderful promises repeated again. Lots of people, relationship with him. Promised land, don't worry, you'll come back. But it's coupled with assurance that he's doing the right thing as he steps into the unknown. Once again, the heartbeat of Genesis brought to our mind. God is a promising God. God's word alone provides certainty. And God's people need to start learning this lesson. That was true for Jacob and his family then. That was true for the people who first read Genesis. And it's true for us today. You see, struggles and setbacks and tragedies form the stage on which salvation history is played out. It's always that way. The genealogy draws us to lots of details that really make that point. It always feels like you've drawn the short straw when you have to preach or indeed read one of the genealogies. But they do form a very important part of biblical literature. They're not written, it's probably just worth sort of absorbing this, they're not written as sort of diktats of legal history. Instead, they're there to make ideological points. The point here is one of instilling trust in his readers. It's meant to make us say, "Oh wow, yeah, God really is doing what he's doing. God really is fulfilling those promises." And there's lots of detail from an ideological point of view. Numbers are huge in Genesis. We won't go into lots of details, but just consider the fact that Jacob, within that little genealogy, Jacob is mentioned 12 times, a number of completeness. This is Jacob's promise fulfilled with all of his family. And then look on at verse 27, chapter 46, verse 27. "The sons of Joseph born to him in Egypt were two. All the persons of the house of Jacob who came into Egypt were 70. Seven, consistently in the Bible, is a perfect number. And I guess 70, well, 7 times 10, it's the sort of perfect number extrapolated, the perfect number made very, very big. A significant step. Remember, Jacob started with no one. He was just a one-man show at the beginning. 70 begins to represent a biblically significant turning point. The representative nation, as they are now, well, one day they would be a force to be reckoned with. On through the Bible, these names can be traced, particularly the 12 sons of Jacob. They are the house of Israel. They are the names of the tribes. And in the end, they are the names that represent all of God's people standing around the throne, worshiping Jesus, the Jesus-centered eternity. You see, when God says he will do something, he does it. So what application should we be drawing from this? Well, you don't have to look far in our world today. Here we are in God's people, and we are surrounded by political meltdown, cost of living escalation, military tension not that far away. Well, that's typical. There's always uncertainty for God's people in this world. And the genealogy draws attention to this, a reminder of the difficulty that Jacob himself and his family have experienced. Verse 15 in the genealogy, we're reminded of Dinah. Do you remember her, the poor thing? She was the one that was raped back in chapter 35. Verse 18, a reminder about Jacob's uncle Laban. He treated Jacob very badly, tricked him into years of forced labor, a real dog. And then there's mentions of Leah, the wife he didn't love. Reminder of his own dysfunctionality, the fact that he's got a wife that he doesn't love. Rachel, the wife he did love, her name's mentioned three times, and she's dead, been dead a long time. So much mess, so much heartache litters the family that make up God's people. And yet God's promises stand. And our job is to trust. One of the primary influences in C.S. Lewis's life was a man called George MacDonald. George MacDonald is referred to by Lewis in a lot of his writing as the teacher. And in fact, Lewis then writes MacDonald into a number of his works of fiction as one of the characters. You can sort of work out who he is. It's really easy to spot in books like the Great Divorce. Lewis referred to him as his teacher. George MacDonald said this: "Few delights can equal the presence of one whom we can trust utterly. Few delights can equal the presence of one whom we can trust utterly." Well, through the book of Genesis, God wants his people to understand, to know him, to trust his promises. You see, when God says he will do something, we can trust him utterly. And that's really important, isn't it? Because the backdrop for life in this world will be a life of ups and downs, uncertainty, even facing death. Genesis says, have a bigger vision of what God is doing, eyes on what God is doing. That is the main agenda. Genesis tells us that we should expect something bigger to be going on in this world than the cares we have of our own life. There will be ups and downs along the way. Through it all, we can be trusted. And so, as I close, I mean, if you're feeling a little bit stale, perhaps, we've just made it through January, we've made it through the lockdown, perhaps you're feeling a little bit stale. Yes, you're trusting Jesus today, but glory, all the stuff we've been thinking about in Romans, it seems a very, very long time away. Well, perhaps the right perspective is given to us here. You see, in the end, it's not the place that's going to reinstill our excitement. It's always been about the King. It's always been about Jesus. That was enough to revive Jacob's spirit, the risen man. And so if you're feeling a little bit stale and let down by earthly relationships, let down by just life, have a bigger vision of Jesus, God's risen King. In him we can trust all God's promises to take place.